So I know that there may have been at least someone who was startled by the title of this reflection, including the word evangelism. Our Universalist ancestors, though, were pretty evangelical in some ways. And we might have something to learn from them. We tend to skim over the Universalists a bit, maybe because they were in decline when they merged with the Unitarians in 1961, maybe because the Universalists were always kind of the poor rural cousins, though it turned out that they had the most money stuck away in endowments, go figure. Maybe it was because we're more comfortable with the early Unitarian focus on reason and the goodness of humanity than we are with the early Universalist focus on salvation and the goodness of God. Take John Murray, for example. Now, he pops up in all the histories and curricula. How many know John Murray? Okay. Some of the same people who know Olympia Brown. John Murray came from England to this continent in colonial times, and he wasn't really the first Universalist minister in this country, though he often is thought to be, partly because he has a good story. Like most Universalists, he wasn't born one. He came to Universalism through Calvinism and Methodism, charged by John Wesley himself to lead Bible studies and preach by the time he was 19. But he ran smack into a problem when he encountered the idea of universal salvation, that all people, regardless of their beliefs or actions, would be saved. His problem? Universalism made sense to him. So he switched to preaching that God would ultimately redeem all people, not just Christians. Now that was good news. That's what gospel means, of course, good news. And once he came to that conclusion, especially a preacher who has formally preached the fear of hell, they can't help but proclaim that gospel. Now, some of you may have heard of Carlton Pearson. Has anybody? Nobody's heard of Carlton Pearson. Oh, you have to know about Carlton Pearson. He's from Tulsa, Oklahoma, a man of my generation, a black Pentecostal minister from a long line of Pentecostal ministers. Revelation struck him in the 1990s that God includes everybody, not just those affirming a specific Christian stance. He started preaching that word, what he called a gospel of inclusion, and found himself losing members from his megachurch. And he was outcast by his lifelong evangelical friends, including his mentor, Oral Roberts. Pearson quotes Oral Roberts as having said, "I need a black son. Richard is my biological son. He has the indispensable name of Roberts, but you are my black son, and I need you by my side." That is how close Oral Roberts was to Carlton Pearson. But those family ties collapsed with Pearson's embrace of the gospel of inclusion. He became a pariah among evangelicals. Now, you wouldn't blame him if he gave up preaching entirely, but he hasn't. He has a really interesting story of how he ended up going and preaching to an LGBTQ congregation, and he had always preached against homosexuality, and it was a revelation to him to preach that word of inclusion to these people who had been outcast and who he felt he had also been outcast and who he identified with. It's a beautiful story. But he's gotten media coverage from NPR to 2020 to all over the place. And once his church came down to a small core group, well, a couple of hundred from the thousands that he had once preached to, he joined the All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church in Tulsa, and he brought his people along with him. And it changed that church in a whole lot of ways, as you may imagine, bringing racial diversity and different styles of worship to supplement what they already had. And now there are not one but two movies about him. Come Sunday on Netflix tells the story of his excommunication with Chiwetel Ejiofor playing Pearson and Martin Sheen playing Oral Roberts. I really enjoyed watching that. And there's a new documentary that's just out, American Heretics, that features Pearson along with some other Oklahoma Congregationalists and UUs. And I'd love for us to co-sponsor a screening of that with First Congregational Church. If anybody wants to talk about that, talk to me. But Pearson didn't lose his love for God, and he's still preaching it at All Souls as an affiliated minister. So I think about John Murray as a lot like Carlton Pearson, and both suffered for their faith. Murray, after a stint in debtor's prison in England and the deaths of his wife and baby, he decided in 1770 to set out for the colonies and never look back. Especially, he swore he would never again preach universalism. But that was before he met Thomas Potter, who was a self-educated farmer on the New Jersey coast, where Murray ended up stranded by the winds. Potter, influenced by both Baptists and Quakers, believed in a loving God, and Murray described him as a friend to strangers and a feeling, faithful man whose hospitable doors were open to everyone and whose heart was devoted to God. So Potter didn't see any evidence of hell, and he'd built a chapel on his land where he was convinced that a preacher would come to preach universal salvation. He was a bit of a mystic, so he knew that when Murray showed up, he was the man to do it. Why else would God have stranded him here at Good Luck Point in New Jersey? So Murray refused at first. He had sworn he was never going to preach universalism again. But finally he agreed that if the wind hadn't shifted by Sunday, he'd do it. And you can guess what happened. No shift in the wind. Murray did preach and went on to become among the foremost universalist preachers in early America, often called the father of universalism in America. And along with others who agreed with him, he was expelled from the Standing Order churches and formed arguably the first universalist church in this country in Gloucester, Massachusetts in 1779. It remains an active UU church today. Murray has some other interesting things. I mean, one thing is he wanted to serve as a chaplain during the Revolutionary War, and there were people who didn't want to let him do it because he was a universalist, but George Washington said he can be a chaplain. So that's a piece I like to throw in there. And another thing is that he was very instrumental in getting the taxes went to the Standing Order churches, and the Universalists appealed that their taxes shouldn't go to the Standing Order churches, and that was upheld. So he did some very important things. But Murray, I think of in some ways as our Jonah. You know, Jonah didn't want to preach. He resisted the call. Well, Murray did the same thing. He was someone who tried not to share his faith, but he found himself forced to do it. And perhaps that's not a bad model of evangelism for us, a reluctant evangelist, because Lord knows we don't want to share our faith. I've heard it said that the average Unitarian Universalist asks someone to come to church once every 23 years. Now, I think we do a little bit better here, as a number of people report that someone invited them to come here. And that's good, because that's the way most people start attending a congregation in this country. Someone asked them to come. We UUs, though, are kind of allergic to evangelism. John Morgan, a UU historian and minister, tells a story about someone's reaction to him using the word evangelism in a sermon. A woman cornered him afterwards and proclaimed, "Don't use that word again. Ever. We have newcomers here today." He says he wanted to ask them how the newcomers found out about the church if no one had told them about it, but he thought better of that. So the first thing we have to do is separate evangelism from evangelical. Both come from the same root, of course, the Greek word evangel, meaning, like the old Anglo-Saxon gospel, good news or bringing good news. And that's all evangelism means, sharing good news, sharing hope. Evangelical, on the other hand, has come to refer to a specific group of churches that focus on a theology of atonement and conversion. Of course, the evangelical churches are very committed to evangelism, but they're not the same thing. Universalists in the 18th and 19th centuries were just as committed to evangelism. Early Universalist missionaries are pretty inspiring. I especially like the former West Virginian, Quillen Shinn, who came along late in the 19th century. And I like him not because of what he said or wrote. He was a pretty conservative Universalist, thumping more than one Bible in his career. But I admire what he did, planting more than 40 churches in 16 years of traveling thousands of miles a year, when traveling that distance meant saddle sores rather than frequent flyer miles. He preached in every state in the Union at the time and always tried to leave some organization in his wake, if not a church, then a Sunday school or a youth group or a ladies' aid society. He knew the importance not only of preaching the gospel but of building institutions to carry on that message. Shinn and other Universalist circuit riders faced more hardships than we can imagine. Here are the words of Walter Ferris, an earlier Universalist preacher, from his book of sketches, records, etc. On Sunday, the 3rd of February, 1799, a number of us met at the house of Brother Israel Lockwood. This was the first time I ever attempted to preach. I preached without notes. My sermon was short, and so were the other parts of the exercise. After our public service was over, we agreed to meet for a while once a fortnight for public worship as Universalists. In those early days of my preaching, my hearers were generally very few. Sometimes so few attended meeting that I omitted preaching, had only prayer, singing, and religious conversation. Some of my brethren wondered that I was not discouraged, thought I could never succeed as a preacher at all, but I was never discouraged. The sense of duty superseded every obstructing consideration. I had been too fully convinced of my call before I laid my hand to the plow to think of looking back afterward. Convinced of his call. Like others in the century or so that followed, Ferris faced bad weather, rough roads, tough crowds. More than once, Quillen Shinn was run out of southern towns because of the Universalists' historic anti-slavery stance and because of his personal insistence on ministry to African Americans. Conventional ministers and churches did not welcome these heretics to town. And the Methodist circuit riders were out in force too then, actively competing with the Universalists. One such Methodist itinerant griped that wherever he went, Universalists had already been there spreading their damnable heresy. And I suppose that's one of the toughest things about owning up to our faith. Admitting to belonging to a Unitarian Universalist church can open you to accusations of damnable heresy, threats of hell, and legions of tracts appearing on your doorstep. One of our greatest challenges is dealing with the evangelism of others. What they have to share often doesn't sound like good news to us. So how can we receive it? And it has to depend on who's offering it. There's a difference between the stranger on the street who wants to know whether you're saved and your mother or childhood friend who's concerned about your theological drift. Relationship matters. For folks who were really in relationship, for folks who were not really in relationship with, a firm but polite, "I have my own church, thanks," and refusal to engage further may be enough. Should be enough. But for those who really matter to us, it's harder. The thing is, in their reality, we are taking a huge risk to reject a way of thinking and believing that has provided them hope and comfort. And to be able to clearly and honestly let them know that that system doesn't work for us may be an extraordinarily difficult conversation, but sometimes it has to happen. I remember talking with a member of an earlier church that I served, and she was struggling to cope with her mother, who was an ardent Jehovah's Witness. The woman, Tanya, too, had grown up in that faith, and she knew it didn't hold anything for her. But she could see how it had saved her mother's life. Her mother had been a drug addict, and it was the Witnesses who had pulled her out of that life and gave her structure and helped her survive. So Tanya knew why her mother was so loyal, and she knew she had to step away from it for herself and for her children. But it was hard. So what do we do with those we're in relationship with who want to foist their religion on us? We might ask them if they trust that you're a good person. Or maybe if they trust that they have a good God. If they can muster enough trust in either you or their good God, then maybe they can let it be okay. If they can let you be who you are with your beliefs and you can let them be who they are with their beliefs, you will have achieved a better connection. I love that my favorite Southern Baptist cousin came to my ordination, brought her children with her, and at the end of it gave me a huge hug and whispered in my ear, "I still don't get it." That's okay, because our paths may have diverged, but we still love each other dearly. So wouldn't it be better to just ignore religious differences, keep our ideals and values personal in our hearts? Sometimes, yes, wearing religion on a sleeve can offend others or make them uncomfortable. It can violate those religious precepts we hold dear about valuing people above beliefs. But there are other times that we have to say something. Maybe it's that you've met someone who you click with so much that you're sure they'd like to be part of your chalice circle, or that they'd enjoy a worship service here, or musicale. maybe it's that you've stumbled onto differences about public prayer in a community group and need a way to talk about it. Maybe it's that your sister is overzealous in her own evangelism and you want her to know why you don't want her saying that stuff to your kids. Maybe there are ideas you want to share that are rooted in your religious approach to the world. And maybe it's your religious ideals that motivate you to do things in the world, and you need a way to talk about that. So when those situations come, in many of those instances, we freeze. The feeling for me is the feeling, when I'm wondering if it's safe for me to be out to a particular person or group as a lesbian. It's a real similar feeling, that fear of self-disclosure. Will it change how they think of me? Will they understand how it's relevant? Will it push us apart? Or is there a way that it could bring us closer together because they know more about who I really am? And another complication of our Unitarian Universalist evangelism is that our faith is non-creedal. So while most people expect that a church will define for you what your beliefs are about God and Jesus and heaven, we don't do that. So in some ways, there are two separate issues to consider, and I call them the credo and the elevator speech. A decade or so ago, the president of the Unitarian Universalist Association, Bill Sinkford, started promoting the idea of elevator speeches. It comes from the sales profession, the idea that you should be able to tell about your product in the amount of time it takes to ride an elevator together several floors. So in the same way, says Sinkford, we should be able to describe Unitarian Universalism briefly, setting out the high points. If someone wants to know more, they can ask more. So my elevator speech goes something like this. Unitarian Universalist congregations are places where we come together in community in support of our individual spiritual journeys. We trust that openness to one another, to one another's experiences, will enhance our understanding of our own links with the divine, with our history, and with one another. So memorizing a couple of sentences beats the heck out of stumbling around trying to think of something. And the elevator speech comes in handy when someone casually says, "Where do you go to church?" And then they follow it up with, "Unitarian, what's that?" I resist the urge to say, "Methodist, what's that?" I wonder if they could explain any more readily what their religion is about than we can. But other times, what's really called for is something more personal, not what the church is about, but what I'm about, my personal theology and beliefs. And sometimes as UUs, we think that because the church doesn't have a particular theology, we don't need one either. And I don't buy that. Even though we know that much is unknowable, we each have to have a set of operating assumptions, a belief system, to help us understand our existence, to help us cope in times of illness or grief, to make sense of our world. And that's what I'm calling a credo, the Latin word for "I believe," in contrast to a creed, which is a belief embraced by a whole group of people and institutionalized. A credo may change and evolve. In fact, it probably should. As you age, as you gain life experience, as you learn more or come to recognize that you know less. I know that many times in our UU churches, it's been easier to not talk about our differences and to avoid discussion of God or spiritual practices that sustain us or what's in our hearts that shapes our ethics, of our credos. And that may have muted conflicts, but has not been healthy. In fact, I believe that the greatest gift of Unitarian Universalism to the world is the ability to talk deeply about what truly matters to us, even when we disagree on it. And we can learn to do that well within a congregation, and then we can take it out into the streets and into other challenging discussions. And some of those difficult conversations may involve not what Unitarian Universalism is or what this fellowship is about, but what you believe, your credo. You may need to tell your brother that while you know he and his family like to pray before each meal, that you'd like if you could offer a more generic expression of gratitude that isn't in Jesus' name, or share silence together. You may have to explain to your best friend that you're really not worried about hell, and though you appreciate their concern, you'd rather not talk more about it because you're not going to change your mind. Or, as I like to say, I can't go to hell because I don't believe in it. That's something we can even teach our children to say, you know, because they hear these threats of hell on the playground and in school. And to teach them to say, if somebody says you're going to go to hell, just say, "I can't go to hell because I don't believe in it." That may flip them out, but that's okay. But in these conversations where relationship matters, we're always balancing, we're always maintaining the relationship with our own comfort and our own truth, and that's not an easy equation. So, hard as it is, why would we bother to talk about evangelism? I think it's fairly simple. There's some reason you're here. If you've been here before, there's some reason you came back. Somehow, in your experience, in this fellowship, you have heard good news. If you hadn't, you wouldn't be here. And a natural human inclination is to share good news. 20th century theologian and churchman James Luther Adams named two concerns that most of us seek in our religious homes: ultimacy and intimacy. Ultimacy, we need to connect with something, named or nameless, bigger than ourselves. Humanity, the divine, the universe, the holy, the good, the true, mystery, God, something. We need to know that our greatest worries are minuscule amidst the drifting of the stars. And at the same time, we need to know that in our lives we participate in the eternal boundlessness that inspires and underlies the movement of the universe. We are a part of the ultimate, and it is more than we are alone. We seek ultimacy. And the second thing is we seek intimacy. We want to know and be known by others, by simple human beings, like us and different from us. We want to be recognized when we're here and missed when we're not. We want people to prop us up when we hurt too much to go on and to smile sincerely at our good fortune. And we want to know them too. As one member of a UU congregation said when he was asked why he still belongs, "I want to know how all the people's stories turn out." So ultimacy and intimacy bring us here. And what's more, here, unlike many of the churches you could be at this morning, here we can have ultimacy and intimacy without reciting creeds that we question. Rather, we Unitarian Universalists confess our experience that connections with the ultimate and with one another are not dependent on subscribing to a limited set of beliefs. And that message is needed as much as the 18th and 19th century Universalist gospel was in its day. Those circuit riders needed to counter the hate-filled message of hell and damnation that was proclaimed by the revivalists of the Second Great Awakening. Men like John Murray and Walter Ferris and Quillen Shinn, and women like Olympia Brown, proclaimed a simple, clear message. Their words, "God is love," fell on anxious ears. And our message of a liberal faith, of a community that loves alike though thinking differently, of companions walking together in support of individual spiritual journeys, that's a gospel that needs to be heard, especially where the theme of hell and damnation and the threat of a judgmental God still thunder across the landscape. And we can't go on claiming that Unitarian Universalism only appeals to a tiny portion of the population. Sometimes I fear we really want to be an exclusive club, special because there are so few of us. But more people than ever actually agree with us. All the spiritual but not religious, all those nuns, N-O-N-E-S, out there, they're not in churches in part because they don't know about us. And I don't know how many newcomers have said to me over the years, "I never knew that a church like this existed." We're comfortable. We're afraid to expose ourselves as out of the mainstream, and we're afraid that if we do speak up, we'll be perceived as too pressuring, too much like evangelical Christians. So thousands of people don't know that Unitarian Universalism could offer them something that they need and that they want. And that's why I think we need to talk about evangelism, even when it makes us uncomfortable. And it doesn't have to be the evangelism that we've seen. It can be just that quiet, gentle sharing of our own hearts with people who we love and respect. So Walter Ferris refused back in 1799 to be discouraged, though his supporters wondered why he wasn't. Nor should we be discouraged. I don't think we should be discouraged about our sharing of our faith. I don't think we should be discouraged about our sharing of our lights, our hopes, all of that. Remember these words that are often attributed to our reluctant evangelist John Murray. He didn't actually say them. They were put into his mouth later by someone who was writing about him. But he's often credited with these words. Go out into the highways and byways. Give the people something of your new vision. You may possess a small light, but uncover it, let it shine. Use it to bring more light and understanding to the hearts and minds of men and women. Give them not hell, but hope and courage. Preach kindness and everlasting love. So may it be. Amen. Our closing hymn is number 145, As Tranquil Streams. I invite you to rise in body or spirit. Close with words from Unitarian Theodore Parker. BR is a religion that, like sunshine, goes everywhere. It's temple, all space, its shrine, the good heart, its ritual works of love, its profession of faith, divine living. So let us learn from our religion that sunshine, space, good heart, works of love, and divine love. Let us take all that. May they bless us in our journey this week and always. Thank you.